Sunday, everyone, and welcome to another episode. Oh, I forgot that part. Hey, everyone. Happy Sunday. Well, it's weird because I stopped playing the intros, Sherry, and I'm not used to that, so I'm always used to an intro because I take it out because we play the show on the radio. So let's try that again. Happy Sunday, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons. And I'm Jason Ophir, one of your two hosts, here with Sherry Pang. Sherry, hello.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Not too bad. How was your week?
Well, really good. I'm, it's all good. I'm feeling better, and, life is good. I'm back to normal. I don't know if you've ever had it, but I had a little bit of a run-in physically as far as, breaking out and that kind of thing. And anyway, I'm back to normal and 90% better after seeing my traditional Chinese medicine doctor, and I'm all good. It's all good. I'm back to normal, and I feel very, very blessed tonight. So you caught me on a good day, Jason. That's great.
Hey, that's good. Yeah, my week was uneventful for the most part. I'm actually going to be getting some vacation next week, so I just got to work one more week, and then I'm off for 9 days, and hopefully can find something to keep myself occupied.
Are you planning on going on vacation anywhere?
No, I have these fantasies of going camping and fishing, but I don't know if that'll happen. What tends to happen is I just get lazy, sit around the house and watch movies for 9 days straight. But that gets old.
Well,
boring,
if you decide
so
you want to go camping and fishing, come on out my place. You know, you're out in the boonies here.
Hey, you know what? That's not a half a bad idea. You've got a nice piece of land out there.
I know. I've been, very blessed. And hey, the full moon. Is it the full moon tonight? Oh, my gosh. It's wonderful. You can see yonders and yonders on our road. You see the stars because, we're up there in elevation. We're not in sea level. And you can just really see the stars at night. So it's really nice among the forests. And you hear all kinds of howling. And who knows? You might run into Bigfoot.
Well, with the full moon being out, I guess that means people are going to be a little crazy. I remember when I was catching shoplifters for a living, things always got weird when there was a full moon.
Oh, jeez. Wow. I don't know. I just don't know too much about the full moon. I imagine it does. Everything is energy, and it does. I can imagine it does impact some people more so than others. So, I think it's how you believe in what you're aware of. I think that's what we're, where we're at.
Well, I think the moon is a giant UFO, and there's aliens in the moon watching us. So, but that will be for another show. Now, I know you got us a great guest this evening. We're going to talk about something a little bit different and probably hear some really interesting stories. What did you line up for us this week?
Okay, our first-time guest is David Habin. He lives out in Idaho. We're going to talk about, the accident and deaths and dying. And he's a licensed paramedic, not an ENT, since 1979, I believe. And we're just going to bring him on, talk about his experiences, what he sees, how he feels about people that have, been in accidents and death and dying. So I thought that would be something, a different twist than just normal, paranormal stuff. I think this is something that might be very enlightening for people to listen to.
I do know a couple EMTs, not paramedics, and when I talk to them, I always find myself gravitating, asking the same question, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? That's... life.
That's okay,
and death is...
Jason. That's what he's here for. So go ahead and bring him on.
Okay. Let's get him on right now.
Hey, David.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Hey, pretty good. How are you, guy?
Sounds like you're feeling better. You're back to normal, I hear.
Do I sound like I'm bitter? Yeah, you haven't talked to me for a while. Oh, man, I was going through some rough times. But, it really made me turn inward and reflect on my life And, you know, just look at what I'm grateful for, and with the help of God, you know, it's all good. Today it's all good. I'm finally getting some relief as of Friday. So, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Lovely.
That's good.
Yeah. Okay. So what we're going to talk about is, you know, just a little bit briefly about your work as a paramedic, and we're going to just start shooting some questions. And if anybody want to call in, they can call in at 1-215-383-3999, and it's 1-215-383-3999. So if anybody has any questions about accidents, death, or dying, hopefully David will be able to assist you. Okay.
Well, I started out a long time ago. I started out in law enforcement. I lived back in the Chicago area. A town called Hammond, Indiana, right across the state line from Chicago, and did my college work in law enforcement, worked in that back there for some time, and ended up moving out to Oregon. I actually did quite a bit of my paramedic work in Oregon. I did my training at Chemeketa College in Salem and got my paramedic license in Oregon in 79, and worked for a few services in Oregon. I started off working for a service in Salem and started kind of moving south down I-5. I was in Eugene, Oregon for some time, and then my last job in Oregon, I directed a hospital-based paramedic service there, which probably was one of my best jobs in emergency medical services, because besides the ambulance work, we worked in the ER and the ICU of the hospital also. So got a lot of great experience and training there, and ended up in Idaho. I was hired by the Idaho State EMS Bureau and was state training coordinator for the Idaho EMS Bureau for a number of years, and got involved in training. I've taught emergency medical dispatch courses for quite some time and paramedic courses, and I also do evaluations. There's an accreditation process that ambulance services can go through, and I'm an on-site evaluator for that, and I also evaluate paramedic training programs. And in between there for a little while, for a year and a half, almost 2 years, and still actually a little bit, I also work part-time for a funeral home.
So you're around a lot of dying and all that. That's got to be kind of traumatic, I would think that a lot of people wouldn't be able to handle the stressors of that.
Well, that's true. A lot of people can't, and a lot of people don't realize that is actually a big part of being a paramedic. There's of course the science involved. There's the medications. There's all the training we get as far as patient assessment and treatment and things. But probably the most difficult part of being a paramedic is that emotional kind of roller coaster that you get. You have patients that respond very well to your treatment, they do well. You have patients that don't. And sometimes, yeah, there are patients that don't make it. And that's kind of one of the more difficult parts of the job, is the emotional part, being around that. And also just the job itself. When I was full-time in the field, we worked 24-hour shifts. At that time, I had no idea what a weekend was, what a holiday was. You're away from your family quite a bit, and it's very difficult in family life as well.
It's like being a doctor, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
It's like being a doctor.
Well, similar, yeah. And of course, most of the time when I wasn't working the shift, I was still on call. If something happened, somebody called in sick, they had a major disaster and needed extra help. So I was pretty much on call just about all the every time. If I wasn't actually working on an ambulance, I was still on call in case they needed help.
Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the things I've always wanted to do ever since a kid. I never got around to it. I work in a medical laboratory now, but I always thought being an EMT or paramedic would be really fascinating. Now, the difference between an EMT and a paramedic is a paramedic is licensed to prescribe medication. Is that the only difference?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of difference as far as the training. An emergency medical technician, a basic EMT, that's usually about 120, 140-hour course. You're taught what's called basic life support, things that are non-invasive, like you know, doing blood pressure, splints, basic patient assessments, things like that. Paramedic training now, for the most part, is a 2-year degree program in most places. And we're involved a lot more with medications, IVs, interpreting EKGs, advanced airway devices and things that we use, ventilators, and just it's quite a bit more. It's kind of like I guess the difference between a CNA and an RN, somewhere around that.
Yeah,
I think maybe people understand that.
That's a good simile.
pretty big difference there. So over the years, now you've unfortunately had to deal with seeing a lot of people pass away, and I'm probably going to have some paranormal-esque type questions, but I am curious also to hear, you know, some of the stories of the things you've seen, you know, some of the bad and even some of the good. But I guess I'll start off with, you know, asking kind of something along the lines of paranormal. Have you ever had an experience where somebody has passed where maybe they've, this is kind of an odd question, maybe they've talked before they passed about seeing a light or anything like that? Maybe that's a ridiculous question. I don't know.
No, no, not a ridiculous question at all. In fact, it's one of kind of one of the things that I've always been interested in with things like that. I've had some personal experience, but I hear stories from other EMTs and paramedics. There's a lot of stories where people have like a deathbed visitation. We hear stories that patients that are near death will see deceased ancestors come and be with them, like they're coming to help them cross, like they're holding their hand out and saying, you know, come with me, and they make things easier, and they help them cross over. We hear stories like that. That's not infrequent. You know, people sometimes see saints, they see other people, but the visitations, the sights of deceased relatives coming and being in the room with them, that's not something that's all that uncommon. We hear that. I've had a couple of experiences where working in the hospital, we've had patients saying, well, for example, if a spouse was deceased, that they saw their deceased spouse come, other deceased relatives being in the room there, and to some extent even carry on conversations with them, but as if that deceased relative has come to them and say, okay, it's time to go, and I'm going to help you, and makes things easier for them, and they seem very relaxed after that happens, almost like they're ready to accept it, they're ready to go, and they seem very relaxed. So it's actually a positive experience from what I understand.
What's your personal take on that? Do you think that there is an afterlife, or do you think it's, you know, some people's, you know, science says that it's just neurotransmitters firing or some sort of chemical thing going on in the brain? What's your take on that?
I do believe that there's a life after this. I think it'd be, you know, we're intelligent. We have personalities. We have spirits, if you want to call it that, or personalities, and I think that carries on. And I think it might go both directions. I think that there are some people that maybe it's their imagination that they're seeing things, but I would like to think that's very possible that could happen to people.
What about you, Sherry? Do you, well, I kind of already know what you think, but you definitely believe in the afterlife, don't you?
Oh, most definitely. And I even grew up knowing that. My parents weren't religious or anything, but they were both very spiritual. So, you know, it really helps to have an open mind and acceptance of the paranormal and the supernatural or the metaphysical. So, yeah, it's very much ingrained in our culture, and we do a lot of prep knowing if there is any preparation for our families that are going to be going or afterwards. My dad, I remember when my dad had passed, I thought it was a really big farce if I put on a, you know, hired a minister or a pastor to go and do a regular funeral service, and instead, I mean, his belief was Buddhist, so I hired a Buddhist monk from the temple, and he came out and did the rites and the 49 days and help the body transition, the soul transition to the afterlife. So, yeah, it was quite interesting and very enlightening. So, yeah, very much so. So, David, can you share with us, and this is maybe kind of morbid or anything, but, you know, it's interesting how, as a paramedic, what would you say in your career, what would be the worst case scenario that you encountered that really affected you?
And actually, you folks right earlier are saying, you know, that's what's the worst thing you've ever seen. I have a really smart aleck answer to that. Some people, when they come up and say that to me, I say, well, you're the worst thing I've ever seen. But no, I don't. That's not the case. Kind of an answer. Because, you know, it's like why they're asking the question. Some people are truly curious, and they understand how you feel, and they say, almost kind of like comforting, you know, let's tell me about the worst thing you've ever seen, understanding that it's not fun to revisit that. But then you get people that come up to you and say, "How? What's the worst thing you ever saw?" Because they really want to hear about all the gory stuff, you know, and all the nasty stuff. And that's the folks I say, you're the worst thing I've ever seen. So it kind of depends on the reason. I've been a paramedic for 38 years, and I was full-time in the field as a paramedic on an ambulance up until just several years ago. Still do some part-time work because to keep my license up, I need to do skills documentation and things. I just recertified, just relicensed actually in June of this year again. I've seen just about everything there is, but as soon as I say that, something will happen that's never happened before. But I have seen everything from medical problems, traffic crashes. I've worked airplane crashes. The difficult ones, I think, are probably some of the more difficult ones were medical conditions, maybe a heart attack, something like that. Family was at the house with the person, for example, and, you know, I'm there trying to do our job. You know, somebody's doing CPR, I'm starting an IV, giving them medications, trying to get an intubation tube down them to help them breathe. The family's kind of standing there watching. And we like to usher them out of the room when that happens, but sometimes they just don't want to leave. And I think that's probably the real difficult ones, when you're trying to do your best and people are the family especially, they're watching you and they have these expectations, and sometimes things don't work out. You know, sometimes the person does not recover. Sometimes we're not able to resuscitate them. And that's always difficult working, you know, talking to the family, seeing their reactions and things. So those are the difficult ones. Traumatic situations, massive trauma, car crashes. To be honest with you, I've worked two plane crashes. And there was really... those weren't all that difficult simply because there was nothing we could do. We were there, but there was nothing we could do for the folks. It was way too far gone. But traffic crashes where you have people that have very severe injuries, you're trying very hard. You have to extricate them from the vehicle sometimes, make sure that when you get them out of the vehicle that you don't do any further damage to them, to their body. And that's one of the things, actually, science has really improved with emergency medical services just in the past 10 years. Up until maybe 10, 20 years ago, there wasn't really a lot of research as far as what we did in the field as paramedics. I'll be honest with you, there were some things that we did. There were some medications that we used to give on a routine basis for cardiac arrest, for example, an IV med we used to give. And the whole reason we gave it was there was one study that was done on 11 patients, 11 cardiac arrests, and one of the patients got better. So all of a sudden, we're giving that drug. Now, it's based very much on scientific research, and there are things that we routinely used to do that we just don't do anymore, not only because they didn't do any good, but sometimes they're actually detrimental. So we're seeing a lot more research and a lot more scientific research as far as EMS, and that's really gratifying to see. But one particular call that was probably the worst. I don't know if I could actually put my finger on that. But again, the medical calls, like the heart attacks, for example, severe breathing problems, especially where you have family around. And what you do basically is going to determine whether or not the patient gets better or not. And that's kind of a stressful part of the job.
So if you second guess yourself or make the wrong decision, somebody's life could be lost. That must be hard, leaving a scene where somebody's passed away, and you probably ask yourself, you know, what could you have done different? Or I would imagine.
Always, sure. Now there are some when we get there, we know it's not going to work. For example, a cardiac arrest. Somebody has a heart attack, they go into cardiac arrest, their heart stops, they stop breathing. Obviously there isn't an ambulance on every single corner. It's going to take us a few minutes to get there. And if that person has not had CPR performed on, if nothing's been done to them, and it takes us 8-10 minutes to get there sometimes, we kind of know that there's really not much hope, but we try. We do everything we can. But some cases we just know when we arrive that, nothing's going to happen here.
That sounds really stressful. I don't think I could do it. Dealing with all that.
Well, it's a big part of the job. I tell you, it's a big part of the job getting used to doing that, handling your stress. When I first started out, basically, if you were stressed out, if you're having stress, if you're having problems, your partner would tell you, suck it up, forget about it, suck it up. There wasn't really anything as far as treatment or any type of mental health care or anything. And now that's changed. It's a lot different. Again, the past 10, 20 years, literally like post-traumatic stress syndrome and paramedics and EMTs, police officers and firefighters as well, anybody in emergency services. And now most places have mental health help that you can get for that. If you feel yourself stressed, you're encouraged to get help for that. And years ago when I first started out, it was a sign of weakness. You can't handle it. Well, then you need to get some other line of work, something like that. But that's one of the things that's a really great improvement in the business is that is available. If you feel yourself, getting stressed out, you're having problems. That helps available now.
Now, we do have a caller, but I want to ask you a question before we take the caller. Have you ever been to a scene of an accident and been surprised at a miraculous recovery of somebody? Where you're thinking, this guy's going to make it, like almost like to the point of it being some sort of medical miracle that somebody survived?
Yeah. Actually, I have. I've gone up to both medical and trauma, actually, car crashes, where the person is, really, really crunched up in the car, and they recover. We get them out, and they seem to be doing good. They respond well to treatment. I've had a couple of cardiac arrest calls for the patient. I had one when I was working in Grants Pass, Oregon, and we had a gentleman that was out in the not quite the wilderness, but out in the very rural area of the county, and we had close to 15 minutes before we got there. Nobody had started CPR on this gentleman. He had been there without any kind of CPR, no pulse, no respirations for up to 15 minutes. There's just no way that person is going to get resuscitated. It's too long without your brain doesn't have oxygen for a long time. And we had the fire department there. They arrived with us. The firefighters are doing CPR. I got an IV line in, gave him some cardiac arrest, some of the medications that we give. And I'm looking at the monitor, and all of a sudden there's a little rhythm on the cardiac monitor. And my partner said, "Hey, look, we got a rhythm." And I said, "Yeah, it's probably nothing. It's probably just there's a term we use called artifact, and it's just electrical energy, but no real pumping action from the heart. Yeah, it's probably just that." And I reached down to the gentleman to feel a pulse. Son of a gun, there was a pulse there. So once in a while it happens where you just know for sure there's no way this person is gonna be resuscitated or revived, but for some reason they do. They come back.
That's amazing. He was meant to come. His life on Earth was not ready. Was not done.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he must have had something else to do. He wasn't finished here, so.
Yep.
I always wonder what the difference is. You know, some people survive and some don't. It's fascinating. And it makes me wonder if there's some sort of higher power or something else going on. I don't really have an opinion either way. I'm just in a permanent state of confusion regarding the afterlife or spirit.
Yeah.
But I'm hopeful that there is something out there. But let's get to this caller. I've been on hold for about 10 minutes.
Hi, welcome to Paranormal Horizons.
Hi, how are you? I'm enjoying the information that your guest is talking about, and I think I can contribute a lot from a spiritual perspective. But I had a month and a half after my wife passed in 2007, I almost died, and the police got me on oxygen, got me to the emergency room, and I lost consciousness, which I have no recollection of, and evidently I was intubated, which a lot of people don't survive. I was looking to see what the percentages were and what that experience was, because when I got into the recovery, I was unconscious for a couple of days, and then when I was in the recovery, a nurse from ICU had seen me, and she was Asian. She couldn't speak that much English, and she just said, "Oh, you blueberry." I said, because I guess my skin was all blue. I said, "Will you make me strawberry so I can get out of here?" Or whatever. But and when I was waking up, actually, that's when I thought I was dying. My head I envisioned as a big black marble, and it exploded into the universe in minute colorful particles of all different colors, reds, greens, browns, oranges, blues, and what have you. And then as time passed, I feel it was a spiritual thing that happened with my looking at it that way.
So was it kind of like an out-of-body experience kind of thing, like a vision where you kind of exploded into particles?
Well, to put it in perspective, I had lost consciousness on the Friday afternoon, March 16, 2007, and came to an ICU on a Sunday with family at the foot of the bed. And I didn't put much weight on it, but the following Easter, something prompted me to look back at that time frame, and that's actually the time frame of Jesus Christ dying and then resurrecting. And I mentioned it to some reverend type. She said, "You're very special." I said, "No, I'm not special at all, but because of that experience, I do feel I have a special relationship with Jesus Christ." And that's the route that I'm taking for the time that I have left to really show new ways for people to think and do things in spiritual and loving ways to stop the chaos and go into
the paradox. No matter what the cause of your vision was, whether it was just your brain, whether it was something actually that happened, the fact that good has come out of that, that's the important thing.
Well, again, I've had a pretty bizarre life. I've had everything from UFO, paranormal, and near-death with ongoing paranormal, and I actually share common background with the president, but I'm not into the ego like he is. So I'm sort of on a very powerful spiritual path, and I think my wife, who passed a month and a half before I had my near-death experience, I look at her as a spiritual teacher, because she really, we were married 35 and a half years, and she blessed me with the lesson of unconditional love, which is what I say we all incarnate to learn. And as we learn it, we're supposed to be a blessing to others, especially those who can't help themselves. But I'd be very curious to know about intubations and what goes on in that process, because I can't find any records or get feedback. But it was so severe. I'm disabled still from it. I'm in the veterans healthcare system currently, but I didn't even have a workers comp case. I was on a job, and it didn't even go to court. I just automatically got workers comp in New York.
Well, an intubation is just a method of airway control. An intubation is where we will actually use a light to open your airway manually and literally look down to where your trachea and esophagus branch off from each other. And we use that, then there's a long tube, plastic tube that goes down, and we need to visualize that because we want to make sure we put it down the right hole, basically, and it goes down into your trachea. There's a balloon that inflates at the end that holds it in place, and that's just a really advanced way of keeping your airway open. So now we have a direct shot through that that plastic tube from what's called a bag valve mask. It's a bag that we squeeze that forces air into your lungs, and it's a direct shot now using that plastic tube from that down and directly down into your lungs. And that prevents stomach contents from going into your lungs and it prevents air from going down into your stomach. So it's basically it's an airway control mechanism that we can get a really good amount of oxygen under pressure directly into your lungs.
Interesting. And it's been more successful as time progresses with the technology? Because I heard a lot of people don't survive that.
There may be some other term that you're using. Intubation, patients that are intubated usually are in some form of cardiac arrest. So it's not necessarily the intubation that they don't survive because of that, but it's the cardiac arrest itself, the reason that we need to do that. Technology, though, actually has improved. We actually have little devices now literally with a camera, a little video camera on it, so we can visualize where that tube is actually going. And so technology has improved, but it's not necessarily the intubation that the people don't survive. It's the cause, the reason why we have to do it. Usually a cardiac arrest of some kind, heart attack, poisoning, or something like that.
Interesting. Thank you very much.
I thought, too, yep. I was just for a minute tell you about one of the reasons I think I probably went into EMS to begin with. Kind of one of my first death experiences was when I was 12 years old, long before I became a paramedic. And I think that probably had an effect on me that I wanted to get into a line of work where I could help people. My grandmother died of a heart attack. And I actually was holding her when she died. I did not realize at the time that she had died. But this is a long time ago when women used to give themselves home permanents, if anybody remembers those. But I was 12 years old. This had been back in roughly 1964. And my grandmother was over at our house, and my mother was giving her a permanent. And all of a sudden, my grandmother kind of looked funny. And she said, "I just want to go home. Would you just take me home now?" So we got her in the car, started driving, and all of a sudden she just passed out. And I actually held her. I was holding her, trying to keep her from falling off the seat of the car. And I was holding her, and there were some signs that she had died, and I didn't realize it at the time. But she actually died at that point. We took her to a close fire station that had an ambulance. They got her to the hospital. Of course, that was before people knew CPR, really, right? There was nothing that anybody did. So she just quietly passed away. But I think that probably had an effect on me later on, thinking, you know, like, I'm going to get into a line of work where I can help somebody like that. If she'd have had the proper help at the time, maybe she would not have died. You know, I don't know. But having my grandmother die while I was holding her, that was kind of a life-changing experience.
That would be
well,
very
that brings
dramatic,
it right back
and I
to the
remember
spirituality.
Working in the hospital, and the first time I seen death was just a very interesting, you know, it's different when you have family, but when you actually are taking care of people and you actually see death in front of you, and, you know, I was working in a hospital, and they had, you know, code blue or whatever the code, and we ended up rushing into ER, and this lady was on Mother's Day, and she choked out a piece of meat right on Mother's Day, and flatlined on the table. And I was the smallest one, but they had me in the stool doing compressions. It was like, oh my goodness, and her eyes were rolling back, and oh my gosh, it was just, that was one of the few occasions that I did not sleep, literally did not sleep. They lost
her. Oh, I'm sure.
Really.
I'm sure.
She was a very obese woman, and nobody knew in the restaurant how to perform CPR. It was tragic.
I've only seen
one person.
Such
a,
was gonna say, I've seen one person die, an elderly individual, and when she passed away, there was like stuff coming out of her mouth, but she's still moving, but she was dead. It was like eerie, and that gave me some bad dreams for a little while.
Was it like convulsions?
Yeah, the body does very strange things.
No, it was like face contortion kind of thing. It just like, I don't know, residual electroactivity. It was really eerie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, muscles might switch. They actually, when someone dies, there's a term, it's called agonal respirations. And it's kind of not really a precise term because they're not respirations as far as like the person's breathing in and out. But when somebody actually dies, there's a lot of air that's trapped in their lungs. And eventually that comes out, and that air coming out passes through the vocal cords. It makes noises. They pee. They moan. There's a gurgling effect, but it sounds like they're moaning, and it's just air escaping out of their lungs. But people think, oh my gosh, he's still alive, you know. But it's not. My grandmother actually did that, and I didn't realize what they were at the time. But she experienced that as well, and that's something that's very common. The electrical activity, there's still some electrical activity in the heart. If we have them on a heart monitor, we can see the pattern. There's a little electrical activity going on. Sometimes muscles will switch. They have the air escaping, the agonal respirations, and the body can do some really strange things when they die.
And everybody's all different, huh, David? Pretty much, huh?
I'm sorry?
I said everybody's pretty much different in what happens to them when they die.
Yeah, everybody's a little different. That's right. It depends on their causes, depends on their physical condition and things, but yeah, everybody's a little different.
Did you have any other questions, caller?
No, I just wanted to say that that's what he was saying. That's where the spirituality again comes into play, helping other people as a result of seeing what the full understanding of what life is, that we are spiritual beings. We came from spirit. Even an atheist can't deny that. And I have met some people that say they're God. I say, do me a favor and tell me how you created yourself. You'll entertain me for about a half a second. But we are all going to go back into spirit eventually. 100 years like the blink of an eye in terms of eternity. So, and you can't take the material goods with you. So I do feel we're fully accountable for everything we do here, and it really is to learn to be loving and to help one another. So a very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
I'll put you back on hold, but I thank you for calling in, and I totally agree with you. My kind of thing is random acts of kindness with all the craziness in the world and ego and anger. I'm hopeful that humanity will really embrace being more kind to others. And I'm sure it's out there. Maybe I don't see it. I've worked in a lot of negative careers, but I know there's still good people out there, and hope that I can put the message out there to really take time to help your fellow man. Now, I did have another question, and I hit it kind of the opposite of what I was asking before about people having near-death experiences and stuff like that. Have you ever heard any stories or have any personal experiences where somebody did have a near-death experience, but it was like going to hell? They validated and were freaked out when they came to?
You know, that's interesting. It's an interesting question. I have to think about that for a minute. Nothing comes to mind right offhand. Most of the time when I've heard stories and actually had people tell me about the near-death experiences, they've usually been very positive. And just thinking back, I don't know if I've ever heard a story or ever had anybody told me anything where it was really horrible and it, you know, literally kind of scared the crap out of them. They're going to be good from now on because they saw what might happen. I honestly don't. I don't recall any stories of people telling me that it was a really negative experience. Not that I personally heard anyways.
That's good. I mean, I don't want to hear validation of hell, so hopefully it doesn't exist. Maybe it does, but it's all very fascinating. And
Well, when you consider most people's vision of hell in the early churches and things, it was based on on a book, you know, Dante's Inferno, the different levels. And that's why so many people think hell is this, you know, the eternal fire and all that stuff is basically from that book. And it's, but it's, you know, it's, I think there are some religions that actually maybe have it a little bit better. My understanding of some of the religions where hell, they don't subscribe to, you know, the fire and the brimstone and the eternal burning and stuff. It's just a place that your spirit is away from the presence of God or your deity, whoever that happens to be. But that's what a lot of religions now are considering hell. It's just that you're not in the presence of God like you would have been if you were in heaven, for example. I know a number of religions are kind of professing that description of hell.
Well, I sure hope it doesn't exist. So I have another question, and this is a personal question, and it's kind of nerdy, so the listeners are going to have no idea what I'm talking about, but I got to ask this question. So what can you tell me about non-specific ST changes if somebody has their EKG changes to that, or that comes up,
okay,
or that's interpreted?
I'm sorry, say that again. So,
a non-specific ST anomaly or changes on the EKG?
Oh, okay. Boy, that is nerdy.
It popped up on mine, so I have you on the show.
Okay.
So they didn't say anything to me about it. It was just interpreted by somebody that read. So they weren't concerned about it, but I'm just wondering what.
The EKG, the different points of the EKG are labeled with letters. For example, the heartbeat, for example, when your heart contracts, it's the QRS complex, and the ST part of it is after the heart beats, then it kind of recharges and gets ready for the next beat. And sometimes there's some little anomalies there as the heart's recharging and things. But yeah, generally from my experience it's just one of those benign things that happens to some people, and it really doesn't equate to any type of like heart damage or anything like that. It's just kind of in the electrical conduction system of your heart. It's just a little bit different path that the cells take to recharge and things. And like I said, in my experience, it hasn't been any problem at all. Just some people have it and some don't.
Apparently there was a change from my previous one, but like I said, they didn't say anything to me. I just read that was it, what they saw.
Yeah.
I have a lot of ectopic beats and brief runs of SVT.
Okay.
So it's, you know, tons of PVCs and PACs and I had and this is completely irrelevant, not paranormal in my own personal experience, but since I have you on the show, you know, and I've been plagued with these PVCs and PACs for over a decade. And so I had wore a monitor for 14 days and it had, you know, brief, quick episodes, you know, like 10 beat runs of SVT and stuff like that. So I don't know. My heart is very irritable is basically what it comes down to.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's from your descriptions and I think that's exactly what's, exactly the term I would expect, an irritable heart. Yeah, it all has to do with that electrical activity that's going on, and sometimes it goes a little crazy. There was an interesting call that I had, and there was a very old technique that was taught in CPR classes, primarily to medical professionals years ago when I first started out. And it was for a cardiac arrest that you actually witnessed and the patient was on a monitor. So in other words, you're watching a monitor, they had a normal heart rate, and all of a sudden they went into this abnormal rhythm. It's called a ventricular fibrillation, and it's a cardiac arrest, basically. But it's a whole bunch of squiggly lines on the monitor. And they used to teach that if that was witnessed, you saw it, you immediately took your fist and hit the person in the chest with your fist. And it was kind of like a low-level defibrillation like you get from a defibrillator, like an AED or electrical shock, only it was manual. And that was so ingrained in us when I initially started, it was almost like instinct. And I've only used it once, but there was this lady that we responded to. My partner was putting in an IV line, and I was watching her monitor. And she was complaining of some pretty severe chest pain, and all of a sudden, she went into this rhythm, went into an arrest, and just instinctively, I immediately raised my fist, and I whapped her in the center of the chest. And it worked, which was amazing to me. And it worked so well that she looked at me, and she says, "You hit me. Why did you hit me?" You know. And I'm trying to explain. I actually had to do it once more before we got some medication in her to prevent the irregular heartbeat. But sometimes things like that happen. They're so instinctive, they're so ingrained in you that when something happens, you automatically do it. And by golly, you know, son of a gun, it worked. But she was so upset with me because I hit her.
Wow.
So if I have a tachycardia, will that work? Can I punch myself in my chest?
Actually, what really works with that is called a vasovagal maneuver, and it's like you are trying to have a bowel movement. And you squeeze and squeeze really hard, and that helps it sometimes.
I've tried that before, and it has worked.
Oh, have you?
It's the whole, like, the autonomic nervous system thing.
I wouldn't hit yourself on the chest. I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, yeah. That would look pretty funny. Well, yeah, so it's very interesting. The whole medical thing and science and the way technology is really improved is fascinating. And
I have a one of the I did an ambulance service evaluation, and I wish I could show this to you. I wish your audience could see it. I did an ambulance service evaluation in Canada, Saskatchewan, and in the where I was doing the work at the ambulance station, there was this beautiful painting, and it was a painting of a man laying on the ground. And a couple of firefighters, it looked like, and a couple of paramedics were taking care of him. One was doing CPR compressions. Another one, I think, was holding an IV bag or whatever. But above them, the sky was full of angels. And the angel, there was one angel each, and there was an angel that was laying their hand on the shoulder of the paramedics. And in the background was an angel in black that I've learned later their interpretation was death. And there was a regular angel in white that was literally holding holding death back. And the other angels were down putting their hands on the shoulders of the paramedics and the EMTs so that their work would be successful. And it's a beautiful painting. I've got a copy of it. I took a picture of it. And it's amazing that some of the paramedics that I work with, I happen to think that there's some divine intervention in the work that we do. I think it's a lot more than science. And I've run into paramedics that just totally disagree with that. They said, no, it's strictly science. If the person survives, it's all my good work. And there was nothing else that happened there. And I really have a difficult time with that. Do you really think that you were responsible and everything was just your actions, that you didn't have help from somewhere, you know? And I think that every call I've ever taken, I think I have either felt or would like to have thought that there was something, some energy, some spirit, angels, whatever, that were helping me to make the right decisions, to do the right thing for the patient, and also being with that patient, helping them to respond better to the treatment. I truly think that that happens.
I think that there, you know, it is odd that there are some miracles that happen when people should have clearly died and yet they survived. And it's those stories like that that make me wonder if there is some sort of divine intervention. Look at Rasputin. He was what? Shot, poisoned, and and everything else. The guy wouldn't die. He eventually did. I think they dumped him in the freezing river. But it's just amazing that some people can endure so much, and yet you have other people that can endure so little. It's kind of like the immune system. one person gets a cold and doesn't even register to them, but yet somebody gets the same virus and dies from it. It's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, it's, and we see that in the field. It's unfortunate that there's been a lot of research done, and even my own, not real serious research, but just looking back at the calls that I've taken and how many life-threatening situations or how many calls that I've responded to that really were the result of bad decisions by the patient. I mean, you can't smoke for 40 years and not acknowledge that you're going to have lung problems, you know, or heart problems, things like that. You can't, you know, drink six or eight drinks and get in your car and expect that you're going to be able to drive safely, things like that. You know, there's so many things that happen that are, could be kind of technically preventable.
Absolutely. I know.
So
for
people that may not know, and this may be, you know, a stupid question, but if you feel like somebody's going in and going to start, like, having chest pains, do you perform CPR right away? I mean, for listeners that
don't know,
but what do you do besides call 911? What do you do with a person that is actually in the beginning stages or having a heart attack?
Well, if it's the pain alone, there's the actually what they found, and this again is just through research, the simplest thing in the world, basically, you start having chest pain, you take an aspirin. Aspirin actually helps with heart attacks. And you take that aspirin, you don't chew it, you don't swallow it, you put it under your tongue and it dissolves, and by putting it under your tongue, it gets in your system very quickly. And that actually helps with the heart attack problem. It helps with the cause of that. So if you're, for the patient themselves, that's the first thing they want to do. Calling 911, of course, is especially CPR is only, though, if they become unconscious. They have no pulse and they're not breathing anymore. CPR is just basically artificial breathing and an artificial pulse. So you don't start that until they actually will pass out and don't have the pulse or the breathing. But calling 911 is very important if you have chest pain. That's very serious.
Time is of essence. What happens if you are allergic to aspirin?
Then you don't take one. it's that
simple.
I mean,
is there a substitute other than that?
There isn't. No, actually there isn't. Believe it or not, there isn't a substitute. Tylenol isn't going to do it. You know, basically what it does is it kind of helps open up. Heart attacks are caused usually by a blood clot or a blockage in one of the arteries in your heart, and the aspirin actually kind of gets in there and helps that open up a little bit. And there is no substitute for an aspirin. If you're allergic to it, then you just can't take it. It's just that simple, because you don't want to start having an allergic reaction and a heart attack at the same time, obviously. People that are allergic to aspirin, there's really nothing they can do. Now, there is another medication that's the prescription. People that have a history of chest pain, nitroglycerin. Yeah, there you go, nitro. And that does the same thing. That helps open up the arteries in your heart, helps the blood flow increase in your heart. And that helps with that. A lot of people take nitroglycerin, and that even has improved. There's a spray now, an oral spray that you take almost like an inhaler. There's a nitro spray that you spray up your nose, like a nasal administration of that. But that's the other medication that works really well. And that's, again, that's a prescription medication. But chest pain patients, again, they'll carry that around with them. And they start having chest pain. Yeah, it's the same thing. You pop it under your tongue, gets into your system quickly, and it helps open up those arteries in your heart a little bit, letting the circulation get back to normal, helping that get back to normal. Because a true heart attack, basically, is either a blood clot or a blockage in one of the arteries in your heart. Now you've got a portion of your heart muscle that's not getting any blood or oxygen, and it literally starts to die without that. You know, cells without oxygen and blood flow are going to die, and that's what happens to your heart with a heart attack.
I went to the urgent care one time with chest pain, and they were spraying me with that nitro in my mouth, as I recall. Uh-huh. And then they sent me to the hospital in an ambulance, despite not really finding anything on the EKG, and it wasn't my heart. But I would encourage everybody to err on the side of caution. It's better to pay a hospital bill versus assume that it's indigestion or gallbladder or esophagus or something like that.
Right, right. And as far as the medication, unless you're allergic to aspirin, you shouldn't take it. If you take an aspirin when you're having chest pain, if it's not really a heart attack, if the aspirin isn't going to help, it's no big deal. You know, people take aspirin all the time for headaches. Same thing with the nitroglycerin. If you take it, take a nitroglycerin, and it's not really needed, it's still not going to hurt you. So, you know, like you say, err on the side of caution and definitely get in and get checked out. And a lot of people make the mistake of they're having chest pain, and they try to drive themselves into the hospital. And that's the folks that, you know, on the way they're driving their own car, and on the way in they have a heart attack, or they go into cardiac arrest in their car, have a crash or something like that. So again, erring even more so on the side of caution, if you have chest pain, never try to drive yourself to the clinic or the hospital. Call an ambulance, because the paramedics, when we get there, we can start treatment immediately. You don't wait. That's the great part about having a paramedic level ambulance service like we have here in most places now, Portland, of course, here in Boise, and we're able to stabilize the patient. We're able to give medications and things to stabilize them before we even move them to transport them to the hospital, and you get really definitive treatment a lot sooner than the hospital. That's kind of one of the big advantages of having a paramedic level service. We're able to give the medications and to do all the things that we need to do that normally would only take place 20, 30 years ago, would only take place in a hospital.
And I'm looking at the clock here, and we are actually just about out of time. So I want to thank you for coming on the show. If you have any final thoughts, or if anybody's interested in pursuing a career in becoming a paramedic or an EMT, do they just look at, like, the local community colleges and get started there? Is that the best way?
Sure. Well, I tell you how I started off was I took a CPR class. This is actually, it was in Salem, Oregon, when I lived there. And I took a CPR class. The CPR instructor was an EMT. We got to talking, and she said, why don't you take an EMT class? Just see how you like it. And now, of course, 38 years later, I'm still on paramedics, obviously. I liked it. A lot of community colleges, a lot of colleges, and in Oregon especially, if you have callers in Oregon, there are a lot of colleges there that have it. And it's not a bad idea, actually. There's actually an entry level called, it's called an emergency medical responder. And it used to be called first responder. It was a shorter class, and it was kind of an introduction to being an EMT. And that's not a bad idea to start out at that level just to see if you like it. It's not a long class, and if you're still interested, you know, go on then and get the rest of your training. There's the emergency medical technician is the basic level, and there's what's called an intermediate EMT. They're allowed to do a few extra things, IVs and a couple extra things, and you get the full paramedic level, which is, like I say, in most cases now is a 2-year degree. And in fact, for a long time, your folks, Sherry is in Oregon. She lives in Oregon, and it's actually Oregon and other states, actually, to be licensed or certified as a paramedic, you have to have a degree. So the paramedic level is primarily going to be end up being a 2-year degree, but it's pretty intensive. You've got classroom work. You do clinical time at hospitals. You do ride-alongs with ambulances, and the clinical time in hospitals and with an ambulance is in a lot of cases equal to the amount of classroom time. So it's very intensive training for 2 years, but if you enjoy it like I've enjoyed it, I mean, I love it. And every time I re-license, I think, well, maybe I should just let it lapse, you know, if I'm not going to be working in the field anymore. And I can't let it go, you know, when they pry it from my cold, dead hands, that kind of thing. So that's why I've been licensed for 38 years now, and 2 years from now I'll probably relicense again. That's just something I don't want to give up.
I'm having clinical flashbacks right now because I went to lab school. Incidentally, that school I went to also had an EMT program, and I had to go to clinics and draw blood all day and phlebotomy. So I ended up doing 300 blood draws in my clinicals, and it was okay. It was fun. But anyway, yeah, we're out of time. But I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing that. We kind of deviated a little bit from the paranormal, but it's always great to hear stories, and this, you know, particularly ones where people experience life after death and stuff like that. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Oh, you're very welcome. I had a great time.
Thank you, David, for coming on. We appreciate you.
You bet, Sherry. Thank you. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Take care. Thank you. Yay!
All righty.
Thanks, David. All right, Sherry, we got, well, we just ran out of the 1 minute we had. What do we got coming up next week?
Okay, we're going to be live on air with Barry Gaunt and Maria Wilson Duff. So we're going to go back to Octagon Hall. They're actually going to be doing some paranormal work live. I think about a month ago, we were, Maria did a dry run, and we just kind of experimented for half an hour and see if it worked, and it was it worked perfectly. So next week, we're just going to collaborate with both of them and their little team and go on Octagon Hall, and hopefully we'll find some spirit voices or maybe some apparitions. You just never know. That place is pretty active, I have to say. You know, just by looking at it and the tour that Maria gave us, it was quite interesting. Check out the video at 2123:31. You'll see an entity just dart right through. She was outside and she was just talking about what part of the house it was. And if you see it, you have to play it over and over, but you'll see a dark entity, which is a spirit, mind you, or maybe a shadow person, who knows, but it was dashing right through where the light was shining. So it was quite interesting. Okay. All right.
All righty. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening. We'll be back next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time, and hope everybody has a great week. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Take care, everybody. Peace.